Good afternoon. It's May 18th, 2015. This is the Senate Committee on the Workforce. And welcome, colleagues. Welcome, everyone. We have some work sessions. We're not going to do those yet. We're going to start off with the issue of career colleges. I will say that if any of you are here for 2764, we will be carrying that one over, as well as 2471 and 2472. If fiscals we're waiting for on the
amendments,
on amendments and fiscals on all of them. So we're going to start off with the issue of career schools. We do have we'll have a public hearing on a bill related to career schools, but we thought this would be a good opportunity for some background on the role that career schools play in Oregon's meeting its 40-40-20 goals, and also the role that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission plays in overseeing those schools. So I'm going to open our informational meeting on career schools, and I'm going to bring up a panel of three, Juan Baez-Arevalo, Ronald Sutphin, and Kimberly Johnson. Could you all come up, please? Welcome, all three of you.
Thank you.
And Juan, I hear you're going to start off by giving us some of the background to the department's role, to the commission's role.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dumbro, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez-Arevalo. I'm the Director of Private Postsecondary Education, which is an office within the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It is my great pleasure to present to you and to share a brief overview of the private postsecondary education in Oregon and to highlight the role and the impact of our private career schools in the Middle 40. With me today are two education leaders with personal direct experience owning and operating an Oregon private career school. Ms. Kimberly Johnson is co-owner and director of Veda Institute, and she also serves as the vice chair of our private career schools unit advisory council. Mr. Ronald Sutphin is co-owner and director of the United Bicycle Institute, and he also serves as a member of our private career schools advisory council. Mr. Sutphin and Ms. Johnson will be sharing with you the important work at their schools and the direct positive impact that their schools have in the Middle 40 in our state. First, I would like to provide you with a brief overview of the original HEC, as we call it, as the units under the Office of Private Postsecondary Education were among the first to be transferred to the Commission. This afternoon, I will be highlighting the key responsibilities and functional role of each unit and the broad impact of our private career schools, or PCS schools, as we call it, in our state. The Office of Private Postsecondary is comprised of, as you can see, the Office of Degree Authorization, ODA, the VA State Approving Agency, or VASAA, and the Private Career Schools Unit, PCS. Our common focus is student success, and much of the work that we do is the regulation and oversight of education providers in our state. And it's worth noting the goal that we have within the HEC is to make the units self-sustainable through the fees they collect and the federal service contract with the U.S. Veterans Administration. Next slide. The Office of Degree Authorization is responsible for the Office of Degree Authorization is responsible for ensuring the quality of in-state non-exempt private higher education programs. Some of those are degree-granting institutions, and some of those institutions also offer certificates. The VASAA is responsible for the critical work of assuring that the programs approved for the training of veterans in Oregon are quality programs. And our private career schools unit, PCS, is responsible for the private career schools in our state, of which we have about 193 of them. currently operating in Oregon. Next slide. The Office of the Degree Authorization evaluates and approves degree programs for private, regulated, non-exempt colleges located in our state. An example of ODA-regulated institutions are the University of Phoenix and Everest College. The ODA evaluates and approves distance degree programs offered to Oregonians by colleges and universities located outside our state, and it enforces the laws against diploma mills and coordinates the implementation of SARA, the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement. The Office of Degree Authorization currently has about 27 institutions under approval. Soon, the number will be much less due to recent closure announcements. Together, they offer about 169 degree programs. Of the approved institutions, the majority, 14 of them, are nonprofit, and 13 of them are for-profit. The ones that have been announced for closure are all for-profit. Together, they enroll over 12,000 students in Oregon. Other private nonprofit institutions that are licensed by the ODA, such as Willamette and Linfield, are exempt from day-to-day ODA regulatory oversight. Such independent institutions enroll over 45,000 students. The key function of the ODA, and this is quite the trend nowadays, is the evaluation of and approval of out-of-state distance education degree programs. As we've talked before, there's been an explosion of distance education programs, and currently we have 116 institutions that are authorized and 17 that are exempt under Oregon rules. Together, they serve about 5,000 Oregonians who enroll exclusively in distance education programs, and that's with out-of-state providers. Now, our private career schools unit licenses and reviews private career schools doing business in Oregon, investigates and responds to complaints, and provides significant, I would emphasize that, technical assistance to the schools and would-be school owners.
Juan, can I interrupt you there? Could you give us an example of the kind of technical assistance that you would give such schools?
One quick example. Recently, we had a change in regulations relating to instructional standards and having schools design the instructional outline of their programs. And so imagine a school that had an established program but perhaps didn't quite go through a rigorous process of a standards-based design, and so our staff has been and continues to provide technical assistance to schools on how to design that, giving them ideas. Obviously, we can't do it for them, but we give them resources, highlight some areas, and our evaluation is very constructive. So when we evaluate a proposal of a new or an existing program, and we evaluate the academic structure of that, and when our staff reviews it, they identify areas of improvement, and that in itself creates a great deal of technical assistance and guidance to the schools.
Great, thank you.
So our career schools, they are, you know, the question always comes up, what are the career schools? What do they do in Oregon? So, you know, the 193 career schools that we have in Oregon, they provide certificates to students in vocational or technical training areas. Together, they have a collective offering of about 973 certificate programs. Roughly 9,320 Oregonians or students are enrolled with private career schools, and 3,793 graduate each year. That's the most recent count. These graduates are direct contributors to the Middle 40 and Oregon's 40-40-20 goals. As I mentioned before, in terms of the technical assistance, our private career schools licensing unit mandates very high standards for private career schools. And every so often, and members of the advisory committee will confer that we ratchet it up a little bit as we're adding requirements or we revise requirements in terms of increasing quality and rigor. Oregon private career schools cover all corners of our state, and with over 3,000 instructors with expertise in their respective fields, they create jobs across the state as well. And you can see they're located just about in every single area and corner of our state, which is also an economic impact. A small sample of the diverse programs offered by the private career schools provides us with a quick snapshot of the comprehensive impact that their graduates have on the diverse sectors of Oregon's economy. Now, it is worth noting that adding more private career school programs would help address the gap in the middle 40. This theoretical chart gives us a visual representation of the impact of adding 30 PCS programs or schools per year. I would emphasize the addition of programs at quality schools, such as the ones you will be hearing from today. Naturally, other factors that can help us address the gap in the middle 40 include net migration and the awards produced by Oregon's community colleges. It is worth noting that both the ODA and the PCS unit have extensive collaborative work with state licensing agencies to ensure instructional programs are well aligned with professional licensing standards and requirements. Thank you for your time. Now, Mr. Sutphin from the United Bicycle Institute will present next, followed by Ms. Kimberly Johnson from the Aveda Institute.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, Mr. Sutphin.
Thank you, Juan.
And Chair, do say your name for the record.
Ron Sutphin, Chair Dimbrow, members of the committee. My name is Ron Sutphin. I'm the director of United Bicycle Institute and co-owner along with my wife, Denise Sutphin. And really appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about United Bicycle Institute. We usually call it UBI. It's a little easier on the tongue. But first I'd like to say that it's been a real pleasure to serve on the advisory committee with Juan. Juan's been doing a great job, and along with a couple of program analysts, Peter Gertenrich and Karen Chambers, they've really facilitated us moving forward in the quality of our programs. And so I just want to say how much I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you.
The bicycle industry is a pretty small, kind of passion-based industry. People get into the bike industry because they love bikes, and United Bicycle Institute was founded in 1981, and it was the result of a friend of mine who used to sell tools wholesale to bicycle shops, none of which came with instructions, so a lot of time spent on the phone guiding those purchasing tools on how to use them and put them to good use. And we're really one of the only licensed bicycle education facilities worldwide. We've had students from over 40 states or 40 countries, over 50 states. In 2014, we had about 160 from Oregon. We get a combination of enthusiasts, people looking for personal enrichment to be able to work on their own bikes, but probably the biggest slice of the pie is people looking for careers. And we're happy to report that of those we could track down, over 70% were successful at finding jobs in the bike industry, which was a little over 100 in Oregon in 2014. The Ashland campus, just as a quick overview, again, we started in 1981. We had fewer than 50 students. We had 1 2-week program, and that was it. We've grown steadily since then to over 300 students last year, and about in 2003 we were approved by the VA, so we can accept GI Bill funds. We've done extensive vocational rehabilitation, and after 9/11 we could no longer accept foreign students until we were approved by the Department of Homeland Security, so we're now part of the SEVA system as well, and we issue I-20s to foreign students. Probably at least 10% of our clients are from some of those 40 countries around the globe. So it makes you feel like you've traveled a lot when they get to come and share their cultures. The Portland campus was established in 2009, primarily because we had about a 6 to 8 month wait list for classes in Ashland. And so we went from growing steadily year over year to doubling our capacity in 2009. And now Portland has surpassed Ashland in enrollment. And that's probably partly due to some of the bike industry manufacturers, such as Chris King. They employ over 130 people. Many of them are our graduates. The other thing that the Portland campus has allowed us to do is to start offering continuing education classes. There's about 70 bike shops in Portland, so we've got a nice captive audience of professionals looking to ratchet their careers up a little bit. Okay, we have two basic programs. One is bicycle mechanics, the bike technicians. That's what you would find in a service department in a bike shop. And we've got a 1 week introduction class, a 2 week professional class, and a 1 week advanced class, and students usually piece together their own custom program, probably an average of 3 weeks. The VA program is all 4 weeks, and we also offer a bicycle fabrication custom frame building program, mm-hmm. and that is where students come in and learn how to design and fabricate a custom frame made to measure and handle a certain way. And we have three different two-week courses. Typically, students choose their fabrication of choice and complete one class. The VA program is all three classes. And you might have heard of Travel Oregon. They do a lot of promotion for Oregon, and they just launched a big promotional campaign for 7 bikes for 7 wonders of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And 5 of the people who were commissioned to build those bikes are either instructors or former students of ours. So we're happy about that. Travel Oregon's estimated that the impact to the bicycle business on the Oregon economy is $440 million. Our tuition receipts are just under $2 million, and that's probably less than half of what they spend. They are responsible for their own food and lodging and travel when they come here, and quite often students don't want to leave Oregon, of course. So thanks again for the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of committee. If you have any questions for me, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Okay, we'll, I'm sure we'll get back to you. Ms. Johnson, welcome.
Hi. Hello, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Johnson. I am a partner at Aveda Institute Portland, and we are a cosmetology school with two campuses, one in Portland, the Pearl District, and one across the river in Vancouver. I also am the director of business development at Dosha Salon Spa, with 6 locally owned salons and spas throughout Portland and roughly 160 employees as well. I do serve on, I'm very proud to serve on the private career. You could go ahead and flip to that. Thank you. I do serve as vice chair for the Private Career Schools Advisory Council, and I also serve on a National Professional Beauty Association's their advisory council as well. Thank you for allowing me to take the time. The next slide. Just tells you a little bit about Aveda Institute Portland. We are a certificate granting for-profit career college, and we offer a cosmetology program that's about 2,300 hours, as well as this osteology program at 600 hours. And our students typically that go full-time are with us 35 hours a week. So roughly in that cosmetology program, they are with us in a little bit difference of a couple weeks. They're with us for about a year and a half. In our osteology program, they are with us for about 4 months. We've graduated roughly 900 students since 2008. And we are accredited by NACIS, which is the National Accrediting Commission of Career Arts and Sciences. And due to that accreditation, that is one of the requirements that we do receive Title IV funding with currently no state assistance at this time. And Aveda Institute Portland at this moment employs 48 team members. The next slide, right after that, Really talks about probably the most important thing I think that career schools do, and that's really serving a non-traditional learner. I love this little poem. I won't read it for you. I'll let you all read it. But basically, it is saying that we find typically students do not love math and sciences through high school. They might be a little bit independent, and they have that independent streak. They are definitely the creative thinkers, and they think 4 years is a lifetime. And so I think that it's important to identify that person because it is through career granting schools that we're really serving an element of student body that can join our workforce very well, but might not be served in other categories.
Kimberly, I don't see a single piercing or tattoo on this woman. It seems very atypical to me.
I should really, truly put the real. You obviously have visited our Pearl campus. And so walking around our block, you can see that tremendously. And they love that. The next slide is actually just a little bit, since we are under NACIS, we do have reporting items that I think are interesting. In the cosmetology world, we are held to a lot of standards, and we have graduation rates at this point that we need to report, licensures, and also we need to track our students for 2 years after for placement. And so it actually tells you what the NACIS standard is for nationally, and then it tells you what we are currently doing at Aveda Institute in our last fiscal year. Also noted here is a Title IV default rate. I like this one because it tells me my stomach is like, okay, we're good. And truly, it shows the Oregon default rate in the same cohort year being 14.3. Nationally is a 13.7, and Aveda Institute Portland, a cosmetology school, is at 13.1. The next slide is something I was able to take because of our salon spa experience. And I just liked it because I could dabble into grabbing it without any large information given, but actual data. And so this is on 2014 annual earnings, and I actually pulled stylists all the way back from 2001 to a stylist that's been in the workforce for at least a full complete year, and that was in 2013. Actually, I shouldn't. Yeah, that would be. Yeah, it's a half a year. So, but you can notice that we range anywhere from about 35,000 all the way up to 90,000. And what I think is even more impressive is actually right next to it, that hours worked column. Most of us, I don't know about all of you, 40 hours work week is a typical. So that's a 2,080 hour lump sum at the end of the annual year. And really, we find the majority of our stylists being in right around that 1,600 hours worked for those associated gross incomes. And so they have a very good work-life balance, and that shows obviously in their average hourly wage.
Kimberly, does that include tips?
It does include tips. And so we are an employee-based, so we do actually need to track that. And then the next slide is, since I've shown you what the income ratio is, then what is the outgoing for the debt? And these are just some comparisons of our school being up there, as well as some other top cosmetology schools in the area. Mount Hood Community College offers a cosmetology program. I'm able to put that pricing, but not necessarily the associated or the other credits that are needed or cost to the associate's program. But it gives you at least in line of what that cost is on debt. Then kind of just wrapping up of why is this student important, it really is to serve that non-traditional student. We do make up a very large part of that middle 40, and proud of that. And then we also deliver into the workforce careers because we are a based education to outcome. And so putting out hairstylists, estheticians across the board. And then my last slide, one more, thank you, is, as I said, I was proud to serve on the advisory council for PCS. This does wrap up, again, what Juan had said. I had 198. He has 193. He's probably more accurate than I am. PCS, we are leads-based. I do think that a lot of things happen at our fingertips quicker, all the way from a one-week program to 3 weeks to something that is certificate granting in a cosmetology field or a truck driving school. And so we are really driving a standards and out-based education. And the most important thing that I feel PCS delivers is that we are here to protect the student. And that is a key thing of helping the schools run more efficiently and better, but also in hearing and being a governing body that the students can actually outreach and make those phone calls. So Juan didn't actually mention that many of my independent street type of individuals do want to be heard, and they can pick up the phone and actually make a phone call in and saying, is this the way that my education be run? Is this how I'm looking at this? And Juan's group does a very good job in ensuring that he's being fair on all parts and bringing it together and getting them to a graduated level and out in the workforce. So thank you for your time.
Great, thank you. And just one quick question, Kimberly. So how long is the standard course at Aveda for beautician, esthetician?
The standard for cosmetology, which would include hair design, nails, and osteology. They are three separate licenses under one umbrella. That equates to 2,300 hours. And so if I am doing a full-time amount of work that they come in for 35 hours a week, they will graduate in about 14 months. If they go part-time, it does go just under 2 years.
Great, thank you. Juan, did you want to wrap up?
Any other questions? I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have about our units or the programs.
Great. Yeah, let me start off. You know, the Office of Degree Authorization, or whatever you call it now, the post-secondary is, you know, I think one of the really important elements of the HEC, but it's one that's probably not talked about as much as some of the other elements. But, you know, one of the things, when just a few years ago, I think most people might not realize that some of the schools were overseen by the education department, and then others were overseen by the Oregon Student, at that time, Assistance Commission, and sometimes they were the same schools, depending on whether they were offering both degrees and certificates. And I think one of the successes of the last few years was to bring them together, and then to bring them together under the more general umbrella of the HEC, which is looking at higher education, post-secondary education in general in the state. So how is that actually happening, Juan, you know, this sort of integration, you know, transition? You know, we were hoping it would create more efficiencies and better quality of oversight. Is that happening?
Chair Dumbro, members of the committee, great question. I'll be brief in the interest of time. One of the key steps that we're undertaking is to make sure that the units are self-sustainable. So one of the measurements of that integration is a self-sustainability, looking at the kinds of efficiencies that we can create both on the administrative level. A good example is my position. In the past, each one of the units used to have a director. Now there's just one director doing the job of two former directors, but that creates efficiencies. But we also have an opportunity to share information and processes across the board from within the ODA and the PCS. You're looking at two different regulatory frameworks that existed separately. And slowly we are looking at where we have best practices in one area and best practices in the other, improvements in some of our regulatory systems in terms of our administrative rules and looking at improvements there from both ends. We're also working on the implementation and development of a new database system that will bring both of them together and different reporting systems for the private career schools and the ODA schools, which will, by the way, be very similar to how our community colleges report enrollment and graduates. So we're going to be able to see in the near future apples to apples, not just within private career schools and Office of Degree Authorization schools, but also within the broader higher education umbrella. So it's a very exciting time, lots of work, obviously. And as you know, we have House bills and Senate bills that relate to the work that we're doing, and those bills really emphasize some of the current differences that we have in law, but also some of the efforts to bring some parity.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, you asked the question of Kimberly how long a cosmetology degree takes it, but I don't remember what Rob said for the Bicycle Institute. How long do one of those certificates, did you say it was a certificate?
Yeah.
Okay, how long does it take to get one of those?
It's a program, and they're very short. We have a total of 4 weeks of bicycle technician programs and then 6 weeks of frame fabrication. So per week, it's relatively expensive. It runs about $1,000 per week for the training. But the bike industry is interesting in that there's never been any education. You know, it's been informative for me to be on the committee. And, you know, if you're a real estate school, you've got a real estate board that kind of oversees as well. But in the bicycle industry, even though it's been around for 120 years, no such standards exist. So we kind of are out on our own, and we've become pretty much the default standard for getting someone's foot in the door to get a entry-level job in the bike industry. So typically a student will get job offers the next week when they complete classes. Just checking my email on the trip up here from Ashland, we have a service where a bike shop can request a list of our graduates to potentially hire, and we got 4 requests this morning. And 3 of them from out of state and 1 from Oregon, which is pretty close to the ratio of our student mix.
Interesting. And didn't you say something like 73% of your students get a job in the industry after they graduate?
Yeah, part of what we're required to do is track the success, and we work real hard at tracking that, because if somebody doesn't respond, it shows up the same as them not getting a job. So that 70% is kind of the minimum success rate, but we're still pretty proud of how successful people are when they leave and try to go to work.
And one more follow-up. Do you think some people might just obtain a certificate just for their own hobby purposes as well? And
absolutely.
How would you count that? You don't want that counting against you.
Well, and that's where I really appreciate working with Juan and his office, is they allow us to have students kind of self-identify, if you will. If they're taking the classes for personal enrichment, they still get the certificate, but they may just prefer to work on their own bike, or maybe they volunteer at a community bike center or something like that. So of those who say, I'm here to get a job, those are the people that we track.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And one last thing.
Please.
My daughter says hello. You probably don't remember her, but she's Facebook friends with you. She says you're very nice. She graduated from the Evada Institute in 2010. So, and she's done well with her degree. So.
Great.
Great. Other questions, colleagues? I do have one. You know, one of the challenges that we're facing with private, colleges, particularly now, not the career colleges, but some of the larger ones, is we're seeing some closures,
mm-hmm.
and we're seeing some high default rates. I was pleased to hear how low yours was, and those two maybe are kind of interrelated to some extent, the closures and the default rates and some requirements that the federal government's putting on. So what is the role of the ODA in tracking those, or your office, in sort of seeing where maybe dangers are coming down the pike? I mean, we're hearing some problems with ITT, for example, and so what do you do to prepare for that?
Chair Dumbro, members of the committee, there is a trend, so to speak, at the national level of institutions closing, a variety of institutions, most of which are private for-profit institutions. One of the roles of the ODA is to regulate and oversee those institutions. So sometimes the institutions may be closing not because of the default rates, but because of other regulatory investigations, either at the federal level or at the state level. So one of the things that we're doing proactively is reviewing some institutions. And some of the institutions that have been recently in the media were also institutions that we at the ODA were taking action at the local level. Sometimes we're not as proactive as the feds in announcing to the world what we're doing in terms of regulatory actions. But part of our work is to also hear from students as to their experience. And just as we get calls from private career school students, we get calls from or letters from students at Office of Degree Authorization schools, and we follow up on that as well. We have standards, and it's very important to look at the standards that we have in the ODA in terms of reporting standards, financial standards. And in the last year, in my tenure, we've seen a good number of schools who are in financial difficulty, and we call them at risk and at risk status. Variety of reasons, lower enrollments, or they invested too much or borrowed too much. They're not able to meet their obligations, so that's another factor. Or some of the institutions that are under federal investigation or other investigations. So there's a lot of influences, a lot of different variables that may bring an institution to closure, some of which may be driven by us and our, their lack of willingness or ability to meet the standards, either at the state level or at the federal level. There are current cases. Obviously, we can't talk openly about the current cases, but there are current cases, and there's always work and investigations. And I think that's where the important convalescence of coming together of both the experiences of the private career schools unit staff and the Office of Degree Authorization staff. It's also the sharing of some of those expertise. And one of them, for example, was the closure of schools. Private career schools unit oversaw the closure of Anthem College in Beaverton back in late August, early September. That experience, that expertise, the ability to do a quick response allowed us recently to respond to the HEAL closure and how we're taking proactive steps. So our work, our challenge is to be always on the proactive mode as regulators so that if a closure is imminent, that we are preparing for that. And, we often talked about how do we protect and secure the students' investment. And on the private career school side, we have a tuition protection fund. And currently on the ODA, we don't have a systematic protection for students. And we can talk about that a little later as well.
We will. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, I sometimes wonder, so if a school is in an at-risk status, is there any way for students or potential students to know that? And I ask that question because a couple of months ago we had my office, and I think many of our offices, had some healed students coming through and talking about their program in a very positive way. Mm-hmm. I already heard from, there was already national news about Corinthian and, the larger entities having problems, and they really had no idea that they might be facing an impending closure. And I don't know. How do you handle that kind of thing?
Yeah, those are, Senator Dumbro, Mr. Chair, the difficulties with those kinds of situations is the reality that we're not able to determine a particular date, for example, that a closure is imminent. In cases like that, where there's an ongoing federal investigation and maybe some federal controls, the federal government would, and in this case, continued to allow the school to enroll and to participate in Title IV. So as long as they continue to do that, a closure is not, quote unquote, imminent. Everybody knows, it's on social media, it's announced, it's publicly disclosed, there is an investigation, but that step to close the school, to put some restrictions in terms of enrollment or certain boundaries and then making all students aware of that. One of the things that we required in that particular case, as soon as the federal government released their investigation and actions almost a year ago, late last June, we required that they notify every new student that they would enroll of the situation that was going on with the federal government. So that was in their enrollment agreement, that was in their letters, and that was a very particular Oregon thing that we did in order to protect students, because we wanted students to be fully aware of what was going on before they signed a contract, before they signed with the school. Obviously, we're not in a position to control what the federal government does in that case. If they were continuing to allow them to participate in the Title IV program and to enroll students, kept the institution alive until the federal government took some other subsequent action.
Great, thank you. And Kelly, the Title IV program is a federal financial aid, generally in the form of loans.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you both very much for coming. Juan, you'll probably have to come back up here. And with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on career schools. It's been very informative. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3516A, which is on a very related topic. Matt, would you tell us about it? And Representative Nathanson, you want to come up and present?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3516A requires each school obtaining approval from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to offer academic degrees, to obtain bonds or letters of credit annually, demonstrating school is financially sound and capable of fulfilling commitments to the students. The measure establishes requirements for bonds and letters of credit and specifies the calculation formula for the amount of the bond or letter of credit. It also grants students the right to bring a claim against the school, bond, or letter of credit if the student suffers monetary loss due to the school's failure to provide educational services, and establishes the process for the commission to place the school or program on probation or to revoke approval for the school to offer academic degrees. As it came through the House, it was determined to have a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Representative Nathanson, pleasure to have you over here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. As you heard in the earlier testimony, last year saw the dramatic and sudden closure of a number of campuses of Anthem, a private for-profit school operating in several states across the U.S., and then Heald College in Portland closed recently, leaving 306 students without a complete education. Just last month, perhaps slightly over a month now, the U.S. Department of Education named more than 550 colleges that it has put under additional financial scrutiny because of concerns about management or administration of federal financial aid dollars. Among those listed, five have campuses in Oregon. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission's Office of Degree Authorization certifies and regulates more than two dozen institutions located in Oregon, ensuring that they meet standards in topics such as curriculum, admissions, fees, and facilities. A number of other schools are exempt from this regulatory activity, such as Reed College and Willamette University. And that's kind of an important distinction in who this bill applies to, or who we needed a bill to apply to. This bill would proactively enhance student protection and allow the HEC to identify bonding requirements as necessary when an institution is failing to demonstrate financial soundness. It's for students at those non-exempt institutions that the office regulates. Those students currently have no recourse to recover their tuition payments if a school closes or the prepaid courses are not delivered. This bill would protect students' tuition payments if they are attending a regulated degree-granting institution in Oregon. It would require those institutions to file a surety bond or letter of credit. And it allows the ODA to establish by rule criteria for placing a regulated school on probation, which may include requiring a school to increase or alter the amount of the bond or the letter of credit. This isn't a theoretical problem. As you've heard, schools do close sometimes, and there have been instances where students were left in the lurch, having lost time or money spent on courses toward degrees without a path toward completion. Other states do require this kind of financial protection for student tuition. Oregon should require it also. There are tuition protections in Oregon for students at private career colleges, but not at the other regulated and non-exempt schools. Let's protect the tuition payments for all of Oregon's students. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Any questions for the representative? I'm going to ask Juan to come back up. Nancy, do you want to stay up here? Or? Great. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Do you need to?
No.
Okay, Juan, could you identify yourself again and tell us about the, you know, how you see the agency implementing this this bill?
Certainly. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrow, Vice Chair Tancher, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez-Arevalo. I'm the Director of Private Postsecondary Education, which is an office within the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That's quite a mouthful. Before I go into the details of House Bill 3516A, I would first like to share a little bit of the background and the need of this bill. And I will cover the key areas of how House Bill 3516 addresses the need to protect student tuition. A key role of our office, as I mentioned earlier, is to regulate and oversee private and out-of-state institutions serving Oregonians. In the past year, our Office of Degree Authorization has seen several cases of these non-exempt regulated institutions being at risk and unable to demonstrate financial strength. As a result, in one case, the HEC requested a particular institution to secure a surety bond in an amount equal to the largest amount of total prepaid tuition held at any time. In reviewing our statutory authorities and in comparing what we have for PCS, we realized that the ODA lacked certain authorities and needed to secure the authority to take proactive steps to protect students. With this bill, we will be able to have that authority systematically and to implement the requirements that we're seeking for a surety bond or a letter of credit for all students. Many of the states, and I would emphasize many states in the union, have a surety bond or a letter of credit requirement that ensure tuition reimbursement from private and out-of-state regulated institutions. It is worth noting that this bill would not require institutions such as Willamette University, which is exempt from ODA day-to-day regulations, to comply with this requirement. Section 2 of the bill protects student tuition payments for students who are attending these non-exempt regulated institutions by requiring all institutions to submit a surety bond or a letter of credit. So that is the big change. The schools will be required to annually obtain and maintain a bond or letter of credit demonstrating that the school is financially sound and capable of fulfilling requirements of students. The bond or letter of credit must be maintained by the school for the entire period the school operates in our state. It's also very important. And the purpose of the bond will be to reimburse students for prepaid tuition. In Section 2, it allows the HEC to establish and calculate by rule the amount of the surety bond, so that will be a step that we would be undertaking upon passage, and to set the guidelines for those surety bonds and letter of credit, and also the sample language that we would like to see in each one of them. Section 3 of the bill amends ORS 348612 and clarifies the steps and process by which the commission may place a school or program on probation or suspend or revoke a school's approval. It's an important new step, new regulatory step that is built into the section. Section 3A adds the important step of to the Commission's regulatory actions by requiring that we establish by rule the criteria for placing a school on probation, which may include requiring a school to increase or alter the amount of the bond or letter of credit. So that provisionary step is something that we have not had. We have a suspension or revocation step under ODA, which is it's a steps that we do take, but there's a considerable work in front of that. So the probation is an interim step that would be a good alert, for example, to students and consumers. Finally, Section 3C makes it clear that if a school fails to meet the conditions of the probation established by the commission, that the commission may suspend or revoke the approval to operate in Oregon. So it's that process is very clear. In sum, House Bill 3516A would establish a requirement for schools to regulate requirement for schools regulated under ORS 348606 to maintain and obtain annually a surety bond or letter of credit. It would also clarify that when a school fails to comply with the requirements of approval, including failing to maintain a bond or letter of credit, that the commission may suspend or revoke the school's approval to operate. Ultimately, this bill is about providing protection to students. Thank you for your time. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Could you give us a sense of how this would, using the current example of the failure of Heald College, how would this apply to that situation? And would it have been useful to have had this in place prior to this this situation?
Chair Dumbro, certainly it would be would have been useful to have this in place, not just for Heald, but other institutions who may be in that situation. Always a proactive step like that protects the students at the front end rather than the back end. It would also allow students to be able to submit a claim on their loss. So if they prepaid, and there are students who prepay tuition cash, sometimes you get a gift or a donation from a parent or grandparent, and then it allows them to retrieve those that investment. Certainly, it's the kind of protection that we seek to have for all students. We don't know for certain who's going to be the next Heald, or when, or how. Having this protection at the front end will be very much needed to help students who may be at risk.
So do the Heald students now have recourse to anything, or are they up the proverbial creek? Or?
Well, we at the ODA, Chair Dumbro, sought to place some good old-fashioned Oregon beaver dams in the creek last fall. And we did pursue a letter credit requirement with Corinthian. There was a bond secured for students at Heald, and those students are able to make claims on that bond. We, the ODA, cannot, but the students can, the way that bond was written. And that's the proactive step of the ODA and the HEC of setting ahead a few dams and walls, making sure that we don't have a total deluge downstream when situations like that occur. The steps designed here in House Bill 3516, adding a probationary step, will help have those controls downstream.
Yeah, that's great. You are, for again, those Heald students who still want to complete their education, as I understand it, you're helping them to do the transfer. I know it's challenging sometimes to get the credits, all the credits to transfer, but you're working with community colleges or other institutions to help with that. Could you say something about that?
Certainly. Chair Dumbro, Oregon is quite fortunate to have an integrated higher education system. And it's truly a credit to the existence of the HEC that we're able to coordinate and respond in ways that states to the south or further west out in Hawaii and other areas were impacted by the closure of Heald. And we're able to do so because of that coordination. We had a rapid response team that went out to Heald. We had staff present. We also had a presentation by a representative from the U.S. Federal Financial Aid Office, the Title IV office, that was able to present to students their options. There were also numerous institutions that the ODA helped coordinate their presence
to give students options. So we had community colleges, and we're very pleased to have seen that the integration of community colleges, public universities were open to take transfers, private institutions in our state that stepped up to even house the graduation of those heel students that didn't get to have a ceremony. I mean, details like that. And also private institutions under the ODA in good standing that were able to be present and provide options. So that what was a tragedy became an opportunity for students to decide by choice, not by designation of the ODA or someone else, but by choice, where would they transfer? Who would take the most credits in terms of transfer credits? What would the cost be at the next institution? When could they graduate? Fortunately for the students, HEALD was a regionally accredited institution, and that facilitated some of the transfer credits. We also had placed proactively in that dam some requirements last year for HEALD to have articulation agreements. So our articulation agreements with Portland State, Oregon State, Warner Pacific, that helped also with that transfer of credits. And we're pretty pleased by the attendance and the representation of Oregon institutions, both private, nonprofit, and for-profit present at that, and providing students options. I think they were very pleased. We continue to receive calls, and we will. This is what happens when with these closures. It creates a spike in the workload of our staff. We continue to receive calls either for records. We were very proactive in going in there and securing records immediately, trying to secure ledgers. With the support of our Attorney General's office, doing the necessary letters and notifications that we need in order to secure compliance from the Corinthian group in that process. And we now have under our control student records, most importantly their transcripts and copies of ledgers. So should they be making a claim on that surety bond and they need a copy, our staff in our office at the ODA can help them.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for that answer and for the work that you're doing. Rep. Nathanson, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Nobody has signed up. Is there anyone else here who would like to speak to this bill? Okay, seeing no one, I will close our public hearing on House Bill 3516, and we'll get a work session scheduled. Okay, we have a few work sessions, colleagues. I'm going to start off with House Bill 3114A. Can you remind us of this one? This is one of the workers' comp bills, right?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3114A allows injured workers to file a workers' compensation claim within 90 days after their health benefit plan rejects the claim and requires health benefit plans to pay benefits in accordance with the terms, conditions, and benefits of the plan if the workers' compensation claim is denied. There was no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Vice Chair? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3114A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 3114A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of this bill? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none. So ordered. Who would like to carry this one to the floor? Anybody in a workers' comp move? Senator Rosenbaum, excellent. Thank you. Okay, with that, I'll close our work session on House Bill 3114 and open work session on House Bill 3495.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3495 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 3495 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Matt, you want to remind us of this? This is the one that brings the OPSERP into alignment with the Tier 1 and Tier 2?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is House Bill 3495, and it provides for employers and employee contributions to pension programs and individual account programs of Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan to first be made for new members for wages attributed to services performed for the first full pay period following the six-month probationary period without regard to when wages are considered earned for other purposes. There was a fiscal impact issued, and there was no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion of this one? Any objections to this one? Okay, seeing none. House Bill 3495 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry it. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3495, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2214. And Matt, we remind us of what this one is, and we have some amendments here, don't we?
Yes, we do. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2214 includes Oregon nonprofit corporations as public employers for the purpose of transferring certain public employees. There are dash one and dash two amendments. Both of them are clarifying in nature. One of them clarifies that this bill does not apply to employees transferring from a nonprofit to another nonprofit, while the other clarifies that the source of funding for these positions is still negotiable. There was no fiscal impact on the bill as introduced and no revenue impact, and that carries through to the amendments as well.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher. Let's start with the amendments.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated May 12th, 2015 to House Bill 2214.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the Dash 1 amendments dated May 12th, 2015. Those amendments are to House Bill 2214. Any discussion? Any objection to adopting these amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated May 12, 2015 to House Bill 2214.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the Dash 2 amendments dated May 12, 2015 to House Bill 2214. Any discussion of this? Any objection to our adopting the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, yes. I move House Bill 2214 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2214 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the amended bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I understand that this has been the tradition and the practice. I don't agree with it, though. I know I moved it, but I'm going to be objecting to it, so just so you know.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Knope.
I likewise will.
You have a reason?
Because Senator Gelser did such a good job carrying those bills this morning, I have to vote no this afternoon.
There is the eternal universal balance.
No, I just think in terms of policy, especially with PERS and the way it's at right now, this would only have the effect of potentially increasing that debt and so and increasing costs. So I just think in terms of the policy, it's probably not the right direction to go.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, Zach, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Denbrough?
Aye. Motion passes. I'll carry this. Okay, so with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2214 and open a work session on our final bill. Well, yes, on 2716A. And colleagues, if this seems familiar to you, it should. And our good committee administrator will explain why.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2716A, you may remember as a bill related to disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprises and their certifications that clarify that they must maintain that certification during the entire term of the contract if the contract was awarded on the basis of that certification, and requires contractors to include similar provisions in subcontractors, and requires the contracting agency to verify this certification status during the entire term of the contract, and they may terminate the contract or require the contractor to terminate the subcontract or pursue remedies for breach of contract if that certification is lost. It makes an exception for emerging small businesses that no longer qualify because their business grows, and provides that the Oregon Business Development Department may independently impose civil penalties for each violation of the requirement if the contracting agency itself does not impose the penalty and becomes operative January 1st in 2016, declaring emergency effective on passage. The reason this may seem familiar to you is we actually already worked this out of the committee. However, it conflicts in statute with Senate Bill 584, which has worked its way through the House. So now we need a conflict amendment to remedy the problem.
Okay.
You
want a motion to reconsider?
Yeah, please.
All right. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2716A.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2716A. Any discussion of that motion to suspend the rules? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2716A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2716A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the A7 amendment dated May 12, 2015 to House Bill 2716A.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the A7 amendments dated May 12, 2015. These are the amendments designed to remove the conflict. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Vice Chair, one last time.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2716A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2716A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Yes,
I need to state a potential conflict of interest once again because I have a business that's regulated by Oregon Business Development.
Excellent. So noted. Any further discussion? Is there any further discussion? Is there any